to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It's a new intro, what do we all think?
It's good.
The keen-eyed listener would have heard that it's slightly different to this usual intro that we have.
Yeah.
Pete and I were at the Libertines on Wednesday night and I managed to record when they played our podcast intro.
Is that more illegal or less illegal than what we normally do?
Who knows?
Same amount of
matter for the courts. Look, I'll hands up right now. I think that new intro is mostly me, mm-hmm. to be honest. So would probably be less illegal because I'm the one singing it. I think I'm the intellectual property holder of that. I'm really belting it out there.
Yeah, a lot of passion. I like the passion. I mean, it's not as polished as the usual version.
But no, not at all. I can't sing. But what a concert.
It was great.
But that's not what we're here to discuss.
Pete Doherty didn't refuse our invitation for an interview.
Despite how loudly we yelled at him from about 15 rows back.
Yeah.
But yeah, hell of a time. And let's talk some of the big... Well, we've got a big show for you guys coming up today. We are going to be talking to Evan Mulholland, fresh off a trip to the US, bit of a fact-finding mission. And he also went to the CPAC, which is like a big gathering of conservatives in America. And Donald Trump spoke. He's going to give us a bit of a sense of what the sort of vibe is for conservatives in America, what think tanks are thinking in America about American politics, and what the sort of vibe is on how Trump is doing.
That's right. They brought back some golden Trump chocolate bars, which were pretty yummy.
They were actually delicious.
Actually, so I didn't eat one. That was a lie. Sorry.
Well, I ate three.
I ate two.
Yeah. They were very, very, very good.
When I got there, they're all gone, so now I know why.
And we're also going to be talking to the IPA's Director of Finance and Administration, Andy Poon, a resident Oscars expert, just going to get a few tips on what's going to happen on Monday night and sort of preview his own little trip up. He's actually going to be in the city for the Oscars, which is huge for him. He's very, very excited.
It's going to be on location.
Yeah, and we're going to miss him terribly for the next few weeks. But, Pete, let's talk some stories around the world this week. Well, this one, a bit local, so it's been a gold standard week for Australian political
debate.
You
said a bit local. I thought you were going to say a bit lowbrow.
Ooh, James, that's very clever.
Because I like to put this in under how crap are our politicians file, which is growing every day.
That's a bit lowbrow of you, Pete.
How crap, except for James and Tim.
Okay.
And the members of Parliament that are IPA members. Everyone else is garbage. So obviously we had, during the week, this week, Michaela Cash slur every woman working in Bill Shorten's office because she got some nasty questions from Doug Cameron about her chief of staff who did get sacked for leaking.
Yeah, and in a Senate estimates into employment.
Like, yeah.
It's just the most...
So it's just, you know, throw your hands up in the air and say, what a thing to say.
Yeah, so brief questioning, she says, I'm happy to sit here and name every young woman in Mr. Shorten's office with rumours in this place abound.
Oh, that sounds like a good use of the taxpayers' money.
That sounds like, exactly. I'm happy to sit here is a weird way of putting it. Like, I'm genuinely looking forward to the experience of putting everyone's name through the mud. I also like, you know, she would go after the women.
Yeah, like, great.
Just really direct to the people who aren't there and did nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we had yesterday Kim Carr, the Labor senator, talking to James Patterson. They were going back and forth. Kim Carr started talking about the French Revolution. Then Patterson was like, well, what about the Russian Revolution? Don't quite know where the context was. A video cut out before then. But then Kim Carr says, just randomly, those in the Hitler Youth, pointing at Patterson, would understand that only too well.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, just always go straight for Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
That's the real way. That is what, you know, Churchill would have done. It's what William Buckley would have done. It's Gore Vidal, like the best debaters always say at the first opportunity, describe your opponent as a member of the Hitler Youth.
Yeah, it's like a year eight debating move.
Yeah.
To compare it to the Nazis. Anyway, so yeah, just calling your opponents a Nazi is great.
I also saw last night Paul Bongiorno tweeted James Patterson, because Patterson says, I'm offended, can you please withdraw that comment?
Yeah.
And Kim Carr initially says no. And then eventually does. By the way, Michaela Cash both withdrew the comment, yet also refuses to apologise.
Yeah.
And I think, well, you can do one.
you can't do both.
Sorry, you have to do both. Like, you can either withdraw and apologise, or you don't do either. It's not like, I take it back, but also I'm not sorry. anyway, so... in no way does that make sense. So Paul Bongiorno, you know, former Channel 10 host and Meet the Press... I think he's now doing stuff for the Saturday paper. So he tweeted to James Patterson, does this now make you support Section 18C because you were offended and you've asked for it to be removed?
How long can we go on about this before people actually understand what we mean?
Yeah, exactly.
You can be offended, just shouldn't be illegal. You twit.
I get this so many times where it's like freedom of speech in people's minds means that people can just say things unchallenged.
It's not what it is.
No,
this is more challenging. Anyway.
Ridiculous. Cool. So that was that story. And obviously, we're going to move on to another story now. Pretty heavy. Obviously, what happened in Parkdale, absolutely terrible. the school's back open now, so people are starting to go back to their regular lives. Scott Israel, Sheriff of Parkdale, is a jerk. I want this podcast to be a anti-Scott Israel podcast.
Yeah.
So during a town hall last Wednesday, so obviously like there was a lot of coverage about the town hall. They had people from the NRA there talking, a few students asked questions. It was a huge event. Now, Scott Israel says in this thing, what I'm asking the lawmakers, you know, talking about, what are the fallouts from this? What are people learning? Scott Israel goes, what I'm asking the lawmakers to give police all over this country is more power. Mate, you didn't do anything with the power you had. Everyone cooked it. Israel's department.
Cooked it.
Absolutely cooked it.
Yeah, yeah.
In a very Pete way of describing it.
They stuffed it up.
Yeah. So the deputy inside the place didn't engage the shooter. He's standing there with a bulletproof vest and a gun. He's just like, one report I heard, he's just standing at a door, like defending the door. Yeah. Like, you know, on the other side of the door is the shooter. Then you had three other deputies outside, just like crouched behind their cars, just waiting for the shooter to come out, like while the shooter's still in there shooting. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, another police department came in and was like, so he's still in there. And it's like, yeah, he's just over there. And they ran in and stopped it. And I think they tried to stop an ambulance worker going in because it was an active shooting scene. You know, kids are bleeding out. They can't get medical attention. Everyone cooked it. Scott Israel, by the way, refusing to resign is crazy.
Yeah, well, there's also the, which I'm sure you're about to go through, all the lead up.
Yes. So, again, this is why they don't need more power. They had enough power to stop this. The FBI received at least two tips about Nicholas Cruz, but failed to follow up each time. CNN reports of various sorts of violent behaviors, such as hitting and threatening his mother, resulting in police generating at least, quote, 30 reports going back from 2011.
Yeah.
The vast majority of police calls resulted in no paperwork filed. Like, seriously. Cruz was enrolled at a public school in Broward County, but had been expelled last year from Stone and Douglas for bringing knives onto campus.
Yeah.
Still no one's like, you know, we should probably keep an eye on this kid at all times. So how on earth would more power solve that?
But there was also, like, he was on the internet saying, I'm going to be a school shooter.
On Instagram, he's like, I'm going to be a professional school shooter.
They got a call from someone saying, this guy's getting guns.
Yeah.
And I think he could be a school shooter.
Didn't follow up.
A member of the public specifically said.
Didn't follow up. Like, honestly, it's the most outrageous thing. So Scott Israel gets away. Now, Scott Peterson is the deputy who was inside the school and didn't shoot. Like, he's just standing there. Absolute, yeah.
Had a massive choke.
wearing the body armor, has a gun, didn't go in. So he resigned on the day, and that means Peterson, who resigned last week, is likely to receive an annual pension of at least $52,000. The actual total is likely higher, potentially close to $70,000. In addition, half his health insurance premiums will be covered by the taxpayers.
Yeah.
What a jerk.
Like, see,
No, but seriously, like $52,000 of taxpayer money every year for a guy that
didn't fulfill his
absolutely
duties.
Absolutely did not. Didn't even start to fulfill his duties. Very sad.
So you should read. you should read Stein's piece during the week on this. He does it really well. Pete didn't have what I missed yesterday.
Absolutely. Let's move to something a bit lighter, Pete.
Public art. Well, this is a serious issue too, James. But so Dodge Street in South Macquarie, Melbourne. We don't like to be too Melbourne centric on the show, but there's gonna. Aaron Lane was on the news, Channel 9, Channel 10 during the week, talking about a new piece of public art. In Dodge Street in South Bank, the position where there currently is what's called Yellow Peril, which I'm not familiar, not sure if you're familiar with here in Melbourne, but there's a piece of art called Yellow Peril, which is like,
just seemed to
maybe it was nicknamed Yellow Peril. I don't think that was the official name. It was just like this sheet of yellow plastic. Anyway, there's going to be a new piece of public art in that area, costing James Bolt $2 million.
Yeah, so
didn't breathe for a while there.
Yeah, just remember to breathe, Pete. I know public art riles you up.
Yeah.
There's two things I want to take umbrage with of what you said here.
Yeah, go for
one,
it.
One, there isn't public art yet. We've spent $2 million already and nothing has so far been commissioned.
Yeah. We've hired an Irish art consultant.
An Irish art consultant. The name I wrote down somewhere here. Very Claffey. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
But it's probably,
like,
probably.
So it's an Irish art consultant for an international contract.
Yep.
If you are going to spend $2 million on public art, shouldn't it go to a local artist?
Yeah, exactly.
We're
just
flying in someone. If you're going to say, we're going to be the cultural capital of Melbourne by in no way helping Melbournean artists.
Yeah, if you're going to just set our money on fire.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we just at least hire? Anyway, but the good thing, so what we've included the links on Have That I Miss.
Yeah.
And there's obviously Aaron Lane, who's magnificent, but there's also this bloke from Melbourne Uni, an associate professor of public art.
Has anyone ever sounded more like Yoda?
He's got such a funny voice, which is not the point, but it is funny.
It's noteworthy.
It's not the point, but it's funny.
It's noteworthy.
He's just an art historian, you know, like he doesn't know anything. So he said, public art is about stimulating debate and ideas, and that's fine, but do it with your own money.
Exactly.
And why can't, this is a great example of, you should be able to voluntarily fund stuff. So if you think the government should spend heaps of money on public art, mm-hmm. you should be able to tick a little box on your tax return or whatever,
oh, yeah.
and they will tax you for that. And if Absolutely. You don't want to spend money on it, then we'll see if there's $2 million to spend on it. Won't be James. Won't be Nina. What do you think, Nina?
It would just be that art professor. So I also like in that where he starts talking about Yellow Peril, which you've accurately said neither of us ever heard about.
Yeah.
Actually, where is the Yellow Peril?
Dodge Street, South Bank. Oh, no, sorry. Don't know.
It's definitely in South Bank, though. Yeah, exactly. I don't really go to South Bank a whole lot, but I've never heard of Yellow Peril. And then in the news report, they're flying around like all the different public artworks that Melbourne has. Yeah. I recognise two of them and they're both crap. Like, there's like these giant yellow things near the airport, yeah, which is the thing, but they look like the cheese sticks. They look like they're about to fall on. Always freaked the hell out of me when I was like 5 years old. I'm like, that building's about to fall on our car.
Okay. Yeah.
And the other one's like those creepy skeleton things on Bourke Street.
Mm.
Oh, the lanky
one.
What's
going on there?
The old man.
Anyway. I like them.
What?
I don't mind the old
man. I know, it's just like Slenderman.
So are you saying that you like them because they're slender?
I think so. Because I'm not slender, so.
Yeah, see, no.
So you like them because they like exercise and eat vegetables.
I was like, whoa, this meat.
Okay, I can tell Pete doesn't know what Slenderman is. Pete, Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that went sailing over your head.
And I did my research for this.
For this aside.
And okay, so Nina would obviously be ticking the box where she, you know, puts $15 towards.
Which I probably not.
I got to say, you guys liking those three freaks at Bourke Street is the boldest take this podcast has ever had.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's it for our opener. We're going to now go to our interviews with Evan and Andy. But before we do that, we should probably talk membership. Nina.
Oh, yes. Membership.
There is a reason you're
Sorry,
here.
Sorry. That's public arts actually distracting me a lot. So if you love what we were just talking and you love what we've done, you're not a member yet, please visit ipa.org.au and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 for a year, you'll be receiving free copies of IPA reviews every year and also weekly emails from James Bolt, Pete Gregory and Morgan Belt. Morgan Belt?
I don't know his name either.
Morgan Beck. Hey, what did I miss?
Very cool. And if you guys like the podcast, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for downloading. We're available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website. And we're also currently in our Hey, What Did I Miss email. I think you could listen from the email itself. So if you like that, make sure you're downloading whatever platform you like. Make sure you're telling your friends, spread the word, get some more subscribers, and have a conversation started between you and your friend about what you think of the podcast, what you think Pete could improve on.
Have a long chat.
Long chat. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure to give us a 5-star rating, and that will help us out with the rankings. So we'll now go to our interviews. Okay, we are now joined by the IPA's Director of Media and Communications, Evan Mulholland. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, very cool. Sorry, Evan, just back from the US, big trip, a lot of fact-finding, a lot of time at CPAC, so how was?
It was very, very good. We met with over 20 different think tanks in Washington and New York. Also went to CPAC, which is the Conservative Political Action Conference. It's the biggest gathering of conservatives.
Political what, sorry?
Political Action Conference.
Okay. Yep. Sorry.
Biggest gathering of conservatives and libertarians and classic liberals in the United States. Happens every year. This time it happened in Washington, just in National Harbor. It was really, really good. Speaker after speaker, all interesting things. Thousands of people there. So it was a really, really good vibe. Very, very pro-Trump, I would say, the CPAC this year. In the past, caught up with our friend Tim Andrews, who's the director of the Australian Taxpayers Alliance, but he's over there doing some work. And he went on about how in past years it was very pro-liberty, and now it's very much pro-Trump. And there was an attitude that Trump is the messiah. He does have his faults, but he has got a lot done. And
because I remember in the election campaign, there was a debate whether or not Trump should even be able to speak at the CPAC, considering he wasn't really a conservative.
Like, exactly.
They've gone from, should we even have this guy, to, you know, this guy's the next big thing.
Exactly. So, yeah, there was a lot of talk about that. And I think that the audience of CPAC has very much changed from being libertarian, very pro-liberty to very pro-Trump. It's almost a personality conference now.
Right.
And the biggest crowd there was, of course, for Trump's speech.
Is it so? Just to, for our listeners, so this is not like a Republican event. This is just an activist type thing.
Yeah, it is technically a Republican event in the sense that CPAC has always been used for future conservative political leaders, future Republican political leaders to test the waters of a potential Senate run or a potential presidential nomination.
Okay.
So in the past, it has been used for that, and it is considered the base. Yeah. In a sense, in the
I was going for in the Republican one, Marco Rubio, used the CPAC speech to really put himself on the national scene a few years back.
So. I don't think he was even invited this year.
So that's a good way of putting it. This is the base, and so they didn't care about stuff like the budget that they put out a couple of weeks ago, not balancing for 10 years.
There was a few speakers saying that was a huge issue and one Trump needed to tackle. One thing that speaker after speaker was going on about as sort of the main achievement of the Trump administration was the amount of regulations that have been removed and the regulation reform. Yep. You know, they originally started off with a sort of one in two out rule to deregulate the economy, and that's ended up being a one in 22 out rule. So it's really turbocharged the economy.
Is that the actual rule? Or is it just that's...
No, that's the effect of the rule is that all these departments have been sent off to find regulations to repeal, and they've basically repealed so many that it's in effect been a one in 20. For every one regulation that's been put in place, there's been 22 removed.
This is shattering what I thought originally happened, which was Trump was handed the final memo and it said one in two out, and then he just looks at all his aides and then just writes another two next to the two. And then just like brings his chin in a little. So he's got a bit of a nod going and goes, how about that? Like, I thought that's what happened.
Six minute abs.
I thought that was what happened and I'm annoyed it didn't happen.
I mean, there was lots of good speakers. There's lots of good side sessions on activism and you know, foreign policy. And some of the side room sessions was really good. We've met with the Right on Crime people that are attacking the criminal justice reform.
Okay.
So there was a lot of speakers there. Probably my favourite speaker was Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, okay.
He was quite good. His speech was really captivating and then sort of went viral. Declared the era of political correctness over. And he talked about things like the left are replacing facts with feelings, and you're not a decent person. The left go on about if you're a decent person, that if you speak your truth, something that Oprah said, but he sort of emphasised that there's no such thing as your truth, only the truth. Went on about the mainstream media, and speaker after speaker attacked the mainstream media, and the mainstream media were sitting up the back of the auditorium, all networks were there, and they were copying an absolute beating from conservative after conservative, guest after guest. And I think probably quite rightly, being in the US and seeing some of the news channels, all of them are obsessed with Russia collusion. And you've got the economy booming. You've got unemployment at record lows. The tax reform has enabled almost 4 million workers in the US now to receive wage increases and bonuses. And all of these companies are bringing billions and billions of dollars worth of capital back into the United States, yet you wouldn't hear about it if you listen to the mainstream media. So the fact that they're spending all this time on Russia, I think, proves the point. I mean, Russia spent like 1/50th of the amount that the Democratic and Republican parties spent, and it's not like they forced, as one speaker said, it's not like they forced Hillary Clinton not to campaign in Wisconsin. You know,
they did get Michael Moore to protest outside Trump Tower, though, so that's pretty powerful.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
So you would have been saying, hi, I'm Evan Mulholland, I'm from the IPA in Australia. Did people know about the IPA? What were their reactions?
Did they know about the podcast? What's the vibe on the podcast?
I actually ran into a fellow by the name of John Batchelor.
He
very much knew
friend of the podcast. Yeah,
of James cool. and Pete. Yep. And he sends his regards.
Thank you very much.
And he can't wait to have you guys back on.
Huge. Cool. All right, sweet.
Lots of people knew the IPA, especially I walked through a few of the booths in the hub, which is the big sort of place where everyone has their stands. Mm-hmm. A lot of the climate change groups definitely knew the IPA, definitely knew the IPA's book, Climate Change, the Facts, 2017.
Available now.
Yeah.
Yep.
A lot of people knew from sort of international surveys. We've got a lot of friends in the United States. We've worked with people like CEI and Heritage and AEI. So we have a lot of friends over there, and a lot of people wanting to visit. based on our visits. So hopefully we get a few guests in the future.
Very cool. So you talked before about how the mainstream media, it's really telling a very specific side of what's going on in America right now, and it's not really resonating with Republicans. This is something I think is going to see Donald Trump win by an even bigger majority in 2020, is just people are tuning out even more of like what the mainstream media, what the Democrats are saying. Does that seem to be the vibe that's going on? Like who are the big Democrats or conservatives we're talking about as like the potential 2020 person? Or are they still just sort of fighting the 2016 election?
I mean, you've got all this policy agenda on the Trump side. You've got tax reform, you've got regulation reform, you've got Paris Agreement, you know, ripping that up, and you've got all these directions on policy. And on the Democrat side, you've got the resistance. And they don't seem to be talking about policy or anything that matters to the American people. And the media are really echoing that. So you've got people like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, you've got, you know, Bernie Sanders, they don't seem to be having any particular direction on which way they're going. So it's, you know, for the media just to go on and on about, you know, Trump resistance and the Democrat Party basically echoing that is passing strange. They're not talking about policy or anything they can do to help regular people.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a shame, because you would have thought that Trump winning and even Brexit and other things throughout the West would really cause a re-engagement of the Democrats back with their base and back with the mainstream. So it's a shame that doesn't seem to be occurring.
I think they're going to have a similar problem that they did with Hillary versus Bernie, in that they'll have a very far left candidate who'd be unpalatable to the establishment versus an establishment candidate. I think the Democrats haven't really learnt from the problems with Trump and the problems with political correctness and going, you know, the Democrats party has basically given up on economic leftism and replaced it with identity politics.
Yeah.
It's all they talk about these days, and it shows how insidious identity politics is, and why some of the right in Australia, or the right of the Labor Party even in Australia, are now talking about how we can't get obsessed with identity politics. We need to focus on economic leftism. Look what's happening to the Democrats.
I saw one event that's like a big fundraiser for someone that's kind of thinking about, I can't remember who the name was, but it was a big fundraiser for someone who's thinking about running, and it was, you know, Q&A with them, performance by Beyonce, ticket cost $25,000. It's like, well, you are not going to win. I can guarantee you right now, you are not going to win the election, because who is generating, like, which regular voter is resonating with that one? But
everyone
anyway,
likes Beyonce, mate.
What?
Everyone likes Beyonce.
Yeah, but $25,000? Let's talk.
Exactly.
So we've got the CPAC vibe. What are the think tanks thinking? What the think tanks you were talking to, obviously, like, you're there for official business, but when they talk about policy, when they talk about Trump, what are the sort of, you know, heritage, reason, the people that you meet with, what are they sort of thinking about it?
Yeah, if you had met with them a couple of years ago, they would have been very depressed, you know, the way the campaign was going, the way it was looking. The Trump administration, as a sort of machine, has actually done a lot of things. It's actually appointed a lot of good people. A lot of, for example, we met with Heritage, who's been working on regulation reform for since the Reagan years. And they had a whole body of work ready to go, basically. They've got a lot of people that did work for Heritage in the administration and were, you know, drafting bills and drafting their regulatory reform bills and orders and executive orders. So a lot of the think tanks are optimistic. A lot of their policies have been adopted by the Trump administration, and the Trump administration seems friendly to right of centre thought. A lot of them are really concerned, especially the people we met with Cato, about orders like we saw today, where he's put a tariff on steel. Those kind of things, and the sort of free trade policies are.
And what did he say yesterday? It's like, well, on the Second Amendment, we're going to take guns first, due process second.
something like that. Yeah. Something like that. They're really keen on guns, and something at CPAC. I think Ben Shapiro Trump did. He tested the audience. What would you rather, Second Amendment rights or tax cuts? And he's like, hands up for Second Amendment rights. And they're like, yeah. And then it's just like, and tax cuts. It was like, yay.
Oh,
and I was like, well, yeah, that was just me. So, yeah, it's just fascinating the political direction of, you know, the base at CPAC versus what the think tanks are thinking. And the think tanks are thinking is really important. And they all spoke about how they'd love to be part of the TPP, but, you know, Trump wants to negotiate a better deal and pulled out. And that was really disappointing.
So. Yeah.
So you're saying the libertarian think tanks are a little bit more sceptical about the free trade stuff?
Yes.
And the conservative think tanks don't mind as much?
The conservative thinks, I think a lot of them are focused on different issues. Okay. What Heritage says is a very different perspective than what Cato thinks.
But I'm getting an overall vibe of optimism here. Would that be right?
I think so. And you only have to look at the economy to realise, you know, how the effect that all these regulations being removed has had. You know, Scott Pruitt spoke at length about the amount of regulations that he's removed as head of the EPA. Could you imagine in Australia if we had an environment minister and a head of the environment department that's job was to dismantle the Environmental Protection Act?
Yeah, I've thought who enjoys their job more than Scott Pruitt in the world?
Oh, it's amazing. Just to think of the amount of jobs that would be created by unwinding a lot of the environmental policies that we have in Australia. This is what they're doing in the United States. And you're seeing, you know, a revival of coal. You're seeing the gas exports booming. You're seeing all this development in their energy sector. And it's really great to see people are getting employed, and regional towns that voted for Trump are being rewarded with jobs.
Mm. I've only got one final question. So, Evan, what have you done with all the material that you were given by Australian Labor Party pollsters when you were in the US?
Oh, yeah. This is fascinating, and something the right is having a lot of fun with in the US is that Bernie Sanders was caught colluding with the Australian Labor Party because they sent over campaigners to campaign for Bernie Sanders.
What did you do
Sanders
with all the material they gave you?
Unfortunately, they did not opt to give me any material.
Well, okay, would have been a good memo. All right, yeah. Evan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Okay, we are now joined for the first time by the IPA's Director of Finance and Administration and all-round giant nerd, Andrew Poon. Andy, how are we going?
Very good, thanks, Bold. How are you?
I'm very well.
What a nerd burger.
Yeah, I also like to call him the Poona Bomber.
Not bad.
Andy Poon, Poona Bomber.
He's actually been very difficult to get a hold of for this interview, as was the Unabomber.
Yeah.
So...
They caught me, so I guess that's why I'm here.
Yeah, but Poon with less of a social life than the Unabomber, but we'll get into it. So Poon, we will get, so obviously Oscars are on Monday. This is Poon's Christmas, I think would be the way of describing it.
One of my favourite days of the year.
Yeah, so you're a big film guy. You've been on an absolute binge over the last few weeks of trying to get all the movies that are nominated for awards watched so you can form your own opinions. I've said there should be an IPA Poonies Award, which is the Oscars, but Andy Poon just tells us what should have won.
Mm.
Is there any intention to bring this bit into fruition?
I think we talk about this every year, and it never actually happens. I do always tell James my favourite picks for the year in terms of what should win, what I think are my favourite movies. And then I think we also go into quite often what should win based on the precursors, based on what the industry voting bodies are doing. But... you know, I guess if we can call this the Poonies for 2018, let's do it.
All right, the actual Poonies. So, good thing I'm wearing a tuxedo and bow tie, and I'll be emceeing tonight. Now, well, let's talk about it. So, I've got here a few of the odds for Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress. So, if people are out there, they're thinking of putting a bit of money down, make things a bit more interesting for them on Monday. Tune in, because Andy knows his stuff. So, let's go Best Picture.
Finance.
Yep.
With finance.
You can break it down financially for us. So, we got Three Billboards as a favourite for Best Picture.
It is.
And Shape of Water just behind it, and then Get Out and Lady Bird back a bit, and then yep. The others are sort of like also-rans. So, what are we thinking?
If you'd asked me a month ago, I would have said The Shape of Water was by far the favourite going in. It had the most nominations out of all the other films. And the industry just everyone seemed to really love it. The last few weeks, Three Billboards have definitely come roaring to the end. And that's why I think if you checked it a few weeks ago, Three Billboards wasn't a favorite in terms of the odds. But
no, Shape of Water were favorite a month ago.
Yeah.
Now, see, what's been happening also is there's a bit of like backlash to Three Billboards. Sam Rockwell's character is like racist the whole way through, and I think he reforms himself at the end. And people are going like, well, we can't have that at the Oscars. Is there anything that's going to hurt it there?
Really?
Yes. I mean, the only thing that probably could hurt it is... I mean, there's two things. That's definitely one. And then two, you've got Woody Harrelson, who's also nominated for Best Supporting Actor from the same film. So traditionally, people would say that film, all the love from that film would be split across the two nominees. And then the other person who's been really at the forefront of the nomination process pretty much the last 6 months was Willem Dafoe for Florida Project. It's a very subtle performance. Definitely not as flashy as Sam Rockwell, but I think he won the SAG. I think all the SAG winners this year favourites for a reason. The last few years, I think the 5 years, with the exception of last year, Denzel won for Fences, everyone else who's won the SAG Award has gone on to win the Oscars. So I'll put my money on Sam Rockwell.
So you don't think the Three Billboards backlash is going to hurt it for Best Picture, but you do think it might hurt it for Sam Rockwell winning Best Supporting Actor, because he is heavy favourite to win Best Supporting Actor.
I would say Sam Rockwell. $1.10. Yeah, I think he's going to win. I think Frances McDormand is going to win, and I think it's going to win the big one as well. So, look, all these things happen. Like last year when Casey Affleck won, there was a lot of backlash over him leading into the Oscars of, you know, whatever other issues are going on at the time, I won't go into it right now.
Alleged domestic violence, yep.
Right? And, you know, he still won. Mm. This year there was a lot of talk about James Franco being nominated for The Disaster Artist, great performance, but again, around the nomination time, there were issues about him, and he did get nominated. So it really comes down to, you know, whether the voters think that is something that they shouldn't be voting for versus what the performance is. But by purely performance, Sam Rockwell should win.
So, Pony, not only are you a massive fan of the movies, the Oscars, you're actually going to be in LA during the Oscars, is that right?
I will.
Are you going to try and, you know, attend?
Break in, do a Tommy Wiseau, stake the stage with James Franco and like lean into the mic?
I would absolutely love to. So what's important is it's obviously a really important big entry night, and the security is insane. They actually block off the main street, you know, the week prior.
Yep. And the week prior.
I think the week prior. And
that's
even
intense.
Perrin's probed it for weaknesses though. So
he's really studied the maps. Yeah.
You know, here's where all the tunnels lead.
When you watch the Oscars, you've got the red carpet and you've got people sitting on the bleachers. They actually they can't just rock up and turn up on the day. They actually go through a ballot process, you know, I think October the year prior.
Okay.
So those people going, they're actually quite lucky. There's a mass amount of people who want to go. I would be one of them, but I didn't even know I was going to LA until maybe like 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
I was planning to be in San Francisco. Figured why not be in the city, and you know, I won't be at the Oscars, but I'll be in the city soaking up the atmosphere during the Oscars.
It's a good cover story for when he eventually breaks in.
Yeah,
he's got a strong alibi.
Do you hoping to sort of run into any industry people out in the town after the Oscars, or you know, around the time?
I will be around, so you never know. I mean, LA is that kind of city where you will just run into celebrities everywhere.
Yeah.
Celebrities are normal people. They do eventually at some point go out into the real world and buy the coffee or walking down the street. So it does happen. So I guess we'll see.
I've always thought you and Hugh Jackman would be good friends. This is my theory. Cool. So I want to ask you this. So just going back to Best Supporting Actor for a little bit. Christopher Plummer for All the Money in the World is 26-1. Now, we've discussed this before. I reckon that's insane odds considering he replaced Kevin Spacey. And obviously the Me Too movement is very strong at the moment. And I think the Oscars might want to say distance themselves from past stuff and say like they really support the Me Too movement. And Christopher Plummer getting it for not being Kevin Spacey, 26-1 is value.
I think Kevin Spacey, no one's actually seen the footage. I think there's a footage that exists in the movie where it would have been too expensive to reshoot because it was a distant shot of him by the train, one of the early scenes. Christopher Plummer is absolutely brilliant in the role, irrespective of whether he was filling in or he spent a year preparing for the role. He is amazing in the role. And I mean, that said, the film didn't get any other nominations. This is his reward already getting a nomination. He's what, 88? He's already a record in being the oldest acting nominee in history. He's already the oldest winner in actor in history when he won for Beginners. So, look, he's got great support. The industry and the voting body love him. I don't think he's going to win, but, you know, if he does, it's. I don't think it's because it's part of the Me Too movement. I think it's just because they appreciate him having great performance.
I think it'd also be part of the Me Too movement. But I got three ones I found.
Respectfully disagrees.
Yeah. nothing about disrespect for me here. So I got three final ones I want to run through here, which will be a lot of fun. Now, number one, mentions of Donald Trump in Jimmy Kimmel's opening monologue.
Good.
Over under 2.5. It's equal odds both ways at 183. Now, Jimmy Kimmel has made himself into the white knight of like the Hollywood left. I think he's going to go for at least 5 or 6. 2.5 is so low for me.
How long does it go for, the actual talk?
Oh, I have no idea. Like 10 minutes, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know Jimmy Kimmel as a comedian that much, so I can't say whether that's part of his shtick, but, you know.
Massive part of his shtick.
Well, then, you should go.
It'll definitely be mentioned throughout the night.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got other ones here. Longest acceptance speech is it going to come from the Best Actress winner, Best Supporting Actress winner, Best Actor winner, or Best Supporting Actor? That's in order of favourite. So who's assuming that all the favourites win, Allison Janney, Sam Rockwell, Frances McDormand, Gary Oldman.
Yep.
Who would have the longest acceptance speech?
I would probably say Gary Oldman, only because he's such an industry kind of, he's been around for so long that people almost expect him to say a lot. At the same time, you would think that, again, part of the Me Too movement, the best supporting and actress and best actress might not only thank everyone, but also make commentary on those sorts of issues. So whether that would drag out the acceptance speech longer, that said, there is a limit to how long they're supposed to talk. So whether...
Doesn't stop people in the past.
No.
Yeah. I think people have actually had to have people come on and say, that's enough.
It does happen when the music plays out.
Yeah. The music plays out. That is good.
It is harsh, but it does happen.
Cool. And last one I got here is... will there be a presenter reading out a wrong award again?
There is no chance.
I
would have said
year.
No chance that it would happen.
What happened last year again? Someone got the wrong card.
So what happened, and I was watching live, and I remember messaging Bolt as soon as it happened. I was giving Bolt a live update. What happened was Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway announced the winners as La La Land.
For
Best Picture. But what happened was they were given the wrong envelope. It was given the wrong envelope for Best Actress, and Emma Stone had just won minutes prior, which is why you're watching the screen, you see Warren Beatty looking really confused, looking at the paper and just looking around. He looks really not sure what's going on.
And we thought it was a bit at the time. Like, he was like hamming it up for the camera, like really extending out the pause.
But as soon as it happened, you know, the winners went up, and you can see in the background that there were people walking on stage, walking around. And something that people probably don't know is this shouldn't happen, and there are rules.
I think people know that shouldn't
happen.
No,
but it shouldn't have gone on for as long as it did.
Yeah.
There are people from PwC on either end who know the winners of every, like, 24 categories. They know exactly who wins.
Yeah.
And as soon as the wrong winner is ever announced, they should actually go on stage and say there's been a mistake and announce the winner. That went on for far too long.
Do people sort of get into their speeches and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the microphone had already
been passed to another speaker. Like, yeah. A few people had gotten involved. And the guy that was like finally caught, he saw people, he must have known that he was about to be cut off, because he was not, he had the microphone physically taken from him, because he's like, look, I know I'm about to lose, so I had a speech all prepared, I'm going to say it. I like that guy.
So the unfortunate thing is that took away from Moonlight having that experience being announced as a winner. It was almost like a very anti-climax moment. But, you know, for La La Land to have basically won for a minute or so, I was quite happy with. For me, that was the best picture of last year, but...
In which Stuart Eade and another staff member here in incredible disagreement with you about. Did they ever find out whether it was true that the reason they gave them the wrong card was because the guy was supposed to give them the right card was too busy taking a selfie with an actor?
There's a rule again. He's supposed to not do any social media while he's doing all the important stuff. End of the night, he posted a photo, I think it was on Twitter or Instagram, a photo of Emma Stone, either in the background or with Emma Stone, and he just, I guess, wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
They've got on both wings, they've got the envelopes with the winners.
Yeah.
So there were two envelopes with Emma Stone's name. She would have been given, or the previous presenter would have been given one, and then she actually kept it. So the other one should have been thrown away, put away, but the wrong one was given, and that's what happened.
Oh, I get it. I get it.
All right, Poona Bomber, thank you very much. Enjoy your trip. We're all going to miss you terribly.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right, thank you to Evan and Andy for those interviews. A lot of fun, good chats.
Yeah.
So we'll now go... Please stop interrupting. We'll now go to a few stories that have made us laugh around the world this week. Let's start off with this. Fraser Anning, Australian Senator, bit of a controversial figure, he was appointed to Malcolm Roberts' vacant Senate spot, and then on the day that he was appointed, said, I'm now done with One Nation, I'm an independent.
That's right,
I still maintain is a case of thinking too seriously about yourself.
Yeah.
Dogging your blokes.
And he's betraying the 19 people that voted for him as well. That's the other thing.
Is that how many? It was some ridiculous number.
Something like that. And obviously, that means below the line, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy. So anyway, We used to have this segment, and maybe we'll bring it back, but it's more of a Q&A clap moment. But this is something, you know, obviously the world of social media really lends itself to political figures using memes to make a point.
Yeah.
And we have this particular meme from Fraser Anning.
What a cracker.
Well, yeah, because it involves crack. So
it does, actually.
So we've got two images here. Would you rather your child do this, and it's someone smoking meth, or this, and it's just someone, like, it appears to be a very stock photo of someone drinking wine, looking to camera.
Yeah.
And it says, let's end alcohol taxes. And there's a few other texts here, but I particularly took a liking to this particular phrase. Would you rather your children smoke meth in a drug house or enjoy a drink at a social venue with friends? So, Pete, what would you rather?
That's a serious question.
Social drink.
Social drink. I did go to a few wild parties in my time, but I think that they would be better than a crack den.
Yeah, absolutely. So he goes on to say, drinking alcohol is by no means without flaws, but we need to realize how expensive it's become that children are choosing drugs over alcohol. And often the high price of a rum and coke at a Victorian bar will send me to the nearest meth den in a sprint. But I do think that this one might be going a little too far for me.
I mean, we're against taxes. On alcohol.
Yeah, so anyway, but obviously Fraser getting out there, getting ahead of a story.
Getting cut through.
Well, it's got about he's only had 78 likes by the time.
That's more people that voted for him.
That is more, so he's four times his audience, quadrupled his audience. So Fraser, enjoy your Q&A clap moment.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, this is when Pete and I would share a Q&A clap moment, but we couldn't think of anything good until, which has never stopped us in the past, but this week.
Doesn't tend to be a
This week, a slightly unlikely source came up with a pretty good Q&A clap moment. So, Nina, you had something to say on the prompt of, would you rather your children smoke meth in drug houses or enjoy a social venue with friends?
I'll prefer my children to be at home.
Thank you.
And the mums,
Nina, the fun mum.
The mums of Australia are just nodding ahead in agreement.
Absolutely. From the behind the wheel of a jet.
Just stay at home, kids. Do meth and whatever you want. Or drinking, but just stay at home.
Oh, okay, do meth at Nina's house. Meth party.
Maths.
I thought you said
I like intelligence people, okay?
Oh, okay, right, okay.
Don't get that mixed up.
Not that one.
I thought that's where Fraser Anning's meth parties are coming from. He's been spending too much time at Nina's house.
Yeah.
Cool, so let's move on to another story, Pete.
Yeah, well, I mean, this one's not as fun as that, but Justin Trudeau, the Canadian...
We don't know that.
Well, it's pretty fun. The Canadian president in India during the week caught the ire of the internet and the Daily Mail with his...
Oh, Daily People.
Thank you. Very good. With
people
his
kind.
Not ludicrous cultural outfits, but his attempts to wear Indian cultural outfits that fell flat with a lot of Indians because they were, I quote, tacky and...
Annoying. Yeah, so...
And the photos are just, oh, you're all...
Yeah, so obviously he's like wearing the most formal clothing you could ever wear in India. And people are saying like, not even, like I've got this one here, a tweet from Umar Abdullah. Also, FYI, we Indians don't dress like this every day, so not even in Bollywood.
Yeah.
And it's like, and he's praying in every photo. He's just got the praying hands happening.
And his stupid earnest look on his face, like he's the greatest human being in the world.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then having copped heaps of criticism for a number of days, then he turned up on day four in a suit.
Yeah, that's what I like so much. Like, it's a brave staffer that says to Justin Trudeau,
stop it.
Yeah, stop it. Wear a suit. Because he'd be like, no, people are liking this.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I'm clearly leading. I'm leading by example here.
And it's so important to, you know, immerse yourself in the local culture, unless you're copying a bit of slack on Twitter.
Yeah, and then...
copying a bit of garbage on Twitter, in which case it's back to the suit.
Yeah, exactly. You guys, like... the limitations of a podcast, you can't see how stupid these images are.
Yeah,
just type in Justin Trudeau in India and go on a visual journey.
It's just like...
The amount of colours.
That's not what... Yeah. You're a doofus. He's
and
a doofus.
A suit.
That's what it is.
He's a big old doofus.
Yep.
Speaking of doofuses, if I may move on to this next story. Wow. So Michael Wolff, obviously the writer, the author of the hit book Fire and Fury, which was just, you know, basically every story Michael Wolff heard at a dinner party for a few months there about what it was like to work in the Trump administration. He decided he wasn't getting enough cut through anymore, so he decided to come out and say that Donald Trump was having an affair with the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley.
Yeah.
Nikki Haley, someone who, you know, is probably going to run for election in the next few years, I reckon. So, pretty massive claim. And so, Ben Fordham, he was getting interviewed on Australian Today Show, Ben Fordham decided to bring him up, just sort of say, like, hang on, So he said it and then, you know, started to say, okay, maybe I'm not as sure about it as I used to be. So Ben Fordham said, don't you think you owe Melania Trump an apology for, you know, putting her life through the dirt like that? Mm. And we'll play the audio.
Do you owe the President and the First Lady an apology, Mr. Wolf?
I can't hear you.
Just last month, you said you were absolutely sure that the President was having an affair, and now you say that he is not.
I'm not getting anything.
You're not hearing me, Mr. Wolf.
I'm not getting anything.
We were hearing each other well just before. You're not hearing me, Mr. Wolf?
Do you hear? I'm not.
Mr. Wolf was hearing me before, but he's not hearing me anymore. So
I'm not hearing anything.
The interview may be over.
So it came out like, obviously, I think he can't hear just based on that, especially when he says, Mr. Wolf, are you having trouble hearing me? And Mr. Wolf goes, no, I'm having trouble hearing you, like nearly saying no.
What a toad.
How spineless. Yeah, what a toad you have to be to be okay with, like, international news. Yeah, Trump's having an affair. And the second someone pulls you up on it, you're going to go, you know what? I'm going to try and not even
I can't even
deal
answer
with
these
this.
Claims.
Yeah. I can't even go like, oh, look, a source got me the wrong info, or, you know, double down, say I'm still thinking it. I don't care.
Prove me wrong.
I'm not going to hear. I'm not going to engage.
And it was good. It was an Australian program and it was news all over the world. So that was, you know, good on Ben Fordham and today.
Yeah, getting
covered by all the American media.
Getting all the exposure.
Exactly.
So, Bolt, this is like how you don't turn up to meetings on time and every single time.
Sorry, I'm just having a bit of trouble.
Plan. Hello?
Nina, what's going on here? I can't hear anything.
Hello?
So, Mr. Bolt, can you hear me?
No.
Anyway, what a bit that was.
Thank you. Bolt. I enjoyed that.
What a parody.
Cool. All right. So, Pete, shall we move on to a bit of chocolate milk?
Yeah, chocolate milk. Illinois Governor Bruce Renner on Wednesday took a gulp of chocolate milk to demonstrate what diversity was. The milk was...
That in itself is the greatest sentence I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, well, I won't take credit because I just read it out of this piece that we found on the internet, but... So the milk is obviously, you know, white patriarchy dominating a company, and the chocolate syrup is all the other people.
Yeah, so there's like a speaker talking him through it, and he adds chocolate syrup to the milk.
Yep, and then he's like, so what is it? So the syrup goes to the bottom, but if you mix it up, it makes delicious chocolate milk.
And it's inclusion.
And then he takes a gulp and is like, oh, the chocolate milk tastes great.
Yeah, it's Yum. Really good diversity.
Yeah.
Now, see, right.
This is the governor of a
state. This is the governor of the state.
So if you drink a white milk,
that's
and then
white
you have a
privilege.
Straw with that chocolate bits on it.
Oh.
What do you say about that one?
Token.
Is it
token? Because there's not enough chocolate to make it true diversity.
Or it's because there's so few chocolate specks that proves that.
Yeah.
It's
the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, there you go.
That's why that can't be done.
Good point, then. You should ask that at the seminar.
Yeah, see, I would be willing to go as far as saying, like, this guy was being set up because of the fact that it was being... Like, he's just holding the milk. It was like, Governor, can you help us out with this demonstration? And then he's just holding the milk while the speaker does everything. And it could just be, like, the speaker going, like, this is going to make him look like an idiot. And the governor just not doing anything. Until the governor leans into the mic, as you say, and goes, it's really good. Diversity.
Yeah.
You're an idiot. You need to drink it. This would be knocked back from the writers of The Office for being too ridiculous. Like, that's no way this actually happened.
Martin Luther King is like, this is not what this is.
What am I done?
This is not what I meant. Anyway, you go now, James.
Yeah, so you guys might have seen a few pics that's happening. There's a massive cold front in Europe right now. My sister who's studying in Scotland just got a trip to Aberdeen next because the conference had to be cancelled because of snow. I think it snowed in Rome for the first time in like 30 years. Mm-hmm. Like people throwing snowballs outside the Colosseum. But good thing they're outside the Colosseum and not at a school in the Joe Richardson Community School in Dagenham in East London.
Mm-hmm.
Because the principal there has banned students from touching snow.
Why?
Well... It only takes, in his words, so obviously, like, yeah, I think we see where those are going, but he goes, it only takes one student, one piece of grit, one stone and a snowball in an eye with an injury and we change our view.
Mm.
I do like that the principal has actually said, I want to remove grit from my students. That's funny. This guy's an actual snowflake in a joke that everyone in the world is making.
Yeah.
Like, banning students from touching.
I think you were the first. You were the first.
No, it's in every article I've read about this, and it's been killing me because I was like, damn it, I independently reached that one. But anyway, so you can't snow because you might start a snowball fight. He's on like Good Morning Britain, and the presenter says, "It's only a bit of fun. Let us throw a snowball." He replied, "If it was that simple, I'd let them throw snowballs all day long." Well, I've got good news for you, Principal. It is that simple.
It's like, and Frank was like, "What does that? What does that mean?"
It's so simple.
Yeah,
I mean, just like you can't touch. Like, how do you get to school if you can't touch snow?
Yep, good point.
Because your shoes are touching the snow.
That's right.
Oh, so but you're not
basically banned school.
But you're not exactly touching this. The snow. If you walk on the snow,
what if it's a really
because you have the shoes, so the shoes that touch the snow, not your feet.
What if you can't afford the shoes, right? Yeah. Then you're just basically hurting.
Well, if you
children.
Can't afford the shoes, you can't afford the school.
No, well, I think it's a public school. But anyway,
yeah.
Point is, this guy's a jerk, and I don't know how you police that because if the student touches the snow, surely you have to stop the student and
touching the snow.
Well, yeah, how a very good way of stopping a student touching snow would be to throw a snowball.
Yeah, exactly. Then they know what it feels like.
Yeah.
Wet. Mm. I had touched snow for the first time only a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I got snowed on for the first time a couple of years ago. It's very cool. Mm. Underrated. We should bring snow back to Melbourne.
Yeah, bring it back.
It's been a few thousand years.
We shall move on. Okay. So I read a piece in The Guardian on Wednesday, which the thing is, they completely misinterpreted, which is surprising, but they wrote...
The Guardian.
If you hate body odor, you're more likely to be right wing, right? So the headline of this piece is, hate body odor, you're more likely to have right wing views. Subheading, scientists suggest authoritarian attitudes may be partly rooted in the biological urge to avoid catching diseases from unfamiliar people.
Huh?
So the thing is, they're saying, hating body odor means that you like authoritarianism, right? But they misinterpreted it because it's the left who are authoritarian in this day and age.
Oh, you're taking that road.
Yeah, yeah, because it's like...
All my jokes are on the right wing side.
Well, we can do
but
this
actually,
in a
you're
second.
Pretty right.
We can do this. You can do your jokes in a second, but it's just like... It's like...
Yeah, now that you started reading it out, I was sort of going like, hang on a minute.
They don't say... The thing. Scientists don't say right wing. They say authoritarian. And The Guardian means, oh, well, that must mean right wing. It's like, no, you morons.
Yeah, my take is... Of course, right-wing people hate body odor more because hippies don't wash,
yep.
And so left-wing people are more used to body odor. That's why. That's yep. My take. Also, at the end of the column, he says about 2% of Trump support could be explained by how disgusted people were by the thought of body odors. I respectfully disagree.
Why is that?
I've not seen the data. I've not conducted my own research. I'm just hearing that, and I'm going, that does not stand up.
That is a classic academic who's like, clearly the only factor that's important in the world about anything is the one thing I'm studying.
It's more, I can't possibly imagine why anyone's ever bought Trump.
Yeah.
So I'm going to concoct that it was because of body odor.
So like 2% of like 50 million people.
Which is like, oof.
What a smelly world.
What is that? Woof. Tell you what, it's making me reassess all principles I hold dear.
I've voted Democrats my whole life, but...
The guy in the booth next to me has got that stank.
Well,
all right,
that's
cool.
All I got about.
That is it for this week's edition of the Young IPA podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you guys so much for downloading. Make sure you're subscribed on iTunes, SoundCloud. Go to our website, it's also available there, and also our award winning, because I gave it an award once. Email, hey, what did I miss? Coming out on a Thursday afternoon. If you are subscribing on iTunes, make sure you leave us a 5-star review because that is extremely helpful.
Mm.
To us in the rankings. And you can also leave a comment. Maybe it's your own Q&A clap moment. Maybe it's a tip for the show. But just, yeah, let us know what you're thinking about. And Nina, let's talk membership.
Yes, if you love what we've just talking about and what we've done for past years and you're not a member yet, please join. Just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll receive four free copies of IPA reviews and also weekly emails of, hey, what did I miss?
Mm, absolutely. It has been such a busy week for the IPA, and that is why this show has been a bit loopy. I think we've been working, Nina and I have been working extremely hard, and I think the outlet has been found. I like them. Let's do more of them. All right, cool. See you guys next week.
See ya.
Bye.